Geek Speak for August 15th, 2015. Today is my 15th anniversary show. Let's listen to my first show. The intro sounded like in 2000. I wouldn't say I really had my chops at that point.
This is Geek Speak. The views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of KOSP. When Oscar Peterson met Vladimir Horowitz backstage on his 75th birthday, it's all on public arts online at kosp.org. Today we're not going to talk about pianos. We're going to talk about computers, as we normally do on Geek Speak. And I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. I'm going to be here for the next month or so, filling in until we find a permanent host. Today I have with me John Tracy. John works at Cabrillo College.
And of course, introduced John, who joined me on air at that time as well, who hasn't been on the show for a while. But today I've got Brian Young. Brian is a CG artist, iOS developer, and general lifelong hacker and tinkerer. Hi, Brian. Welcome.
Hey, Lyle. I love that little quiver in your voice. I can respect that quiver so much.
It's amazing how poignant it was. Also, my flubs and mess-ups and all that go through the episode. This last week I was on vacation, and some of the time I spent was taking old episodes from 2002 to 2006 and getting them online. So the archive of geekspeak.org has a lot more content. Again, hours and hours of Geekspeak. For
15 years that you've been in it. What was it, 17 years for the show?
Yeah, the show started in 98, in March 98, from the people that founded Cruise.io ISP. And then you hear in my first introduction of doing the show that I was going to take over for about a month. The Cruise.io folks got too busy with Cruise.io being successful ISP and asked the station manager to find somebody else. The station manager happened to be my father at the time, and he asked me to jump in just to try it out.
So you were the interim host.
I was the interim host, and it just happened the last 15 years. And since then, when the show started, it was a half an hour. It was mostly a call-in show. We helped people set up their printers and computers and things of that nature. 2000 was early for most people on a personal computer. And we then at one point moved to Friday mornings for a 1 o'clock hour, which was kind of cool to extend the show from that half an hour call-in show to a full hour. It definitely changed the format of the program. For years, the program was me and maybe regular three geeks, I think through 2004 or so. And I mean, this show has followed in technology in a lot of ways.
There's so many amazing things have come out and been released, products that have come and gone.
We introduced Facebook, Twitter, of course. FireWire, I recall, first announcing on the show, first hearing about it because we were talking about it on the show, and its demise since, I mean, it's gone now. You know, FireWire is not, I mean, it's still around, but not nearly the prominence it was.
Well, yeah, I had to use an old machine recently to transfer my DV tapes because it's the only one that had FireWire.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember that technology being talked about for years before it came out. And it finally came out as a huge thing. And now we're on to Thunderbolt, but even Thunderbolt's going away,
it seems like. It is. And Thunderbolt's very close to FireWire in a lot of ways in the protocol. But USB, the newer USBs are totally replacing it. So it's neat to see the technologies come and go. Whole industries merge, like social networking. You know, we had Friendster, but it wasn't the kind of level where everybody was online.
Well, let's see. In 2000, when you guys started, that was just 5 years after the internet was even in the public consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's even discussions about in our earlier shows. We have discussions about what the internet is, what it means, how it works. You know, kind of just core kind of things. I still haven't gotten episodes from 2000, 2001 up. Those are all on CD. And halfway through 2002,
CD.
They're on CD and DAT, a digital audio format as well. But I might get those up at some point. Maybe ask somebody else to do it.
Yeah, we need to find out if any of our listeners have gone back and listened to every single show that's up there. One of the things I think that's really remarkable about this is, we've got lots of geek friends, and geeks are not known for being able to just sit there and talk comfortably in front of thousands and thousands of people. We're not known for our ability to be up on stage so much, but. Well, since GeekSpeak's been going on, you've had more than enough friends that have been able to pitch in and talk.
Definitely.
But also, we've had the entire podcasting revolution, and all these little niche communities out there in the geekdom have their own shows and their own people that are talking about it. And there's actually a surprising number of really interesting, well-spoken geeks out there.
Yeah. And, well, podcasting is one of those technologies that before the when I started the show, podcasting didn't exist really. And I heard about it a little bit. XML, RSS feeds actually existed prior to podcasting exists. It's the same technology. You just have to have an audio file or video file encoded in there. And when it came online, it was probably like, I don't know, about 3 or 4 months before I was like, oh, I should put the radio show up as a podcast. And now I hear like these long-term podcast groups are like, oh, we're at episode 500. We're at episode like 750 of Geek Speak, right? Like it's an unbelievable amount of content. And I have to say a lot of it, I thought I was going to mix together a show this today of a collection of different bits from throughout the history. But the truth is, there's so much. The canon is so large, I couldn't even really dive into it. I could, you know, very clearly edit together like a USB show, right? It would take a week. But I could talk about, you know, describing what universal serial port is and how it works, and then discussions about USB 2 happening and different security vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and nowadays it's all about the hacks that happen in it.
Yeah, exactly. And we also had this wonderful segment for quite a while called USB of the Week by Lucow. And I'll play one a little bit later because they are a lot of fun. We'll play one of those. But so now let's go ahead and get back to starting the show, because one of the things I saw is that the way the show starts over the years changes slightly. I've been using this, the one I'm about to talk about, pretty regularly for, I don't know, probably the last 6 years. This has been the sound of the beginning of the show, though the theme song has changed over the years. So this is how it normally starts. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, August 15, 2015. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the Central Coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinker. Hey, Brian.
Listen to that nice, smooth audio voice you got going on there.
It's amazing. Years of practice. So let's do some follow-up. Freeboot, I think you covered last time we were on the show.
Yeah. Was that just last week?
It was.
It's all blurring together. No. Freebooting was a couple weeks ago. Now, okay. I remember. So we talked about freebooting, and just to catch you up on what that is, I have to remind you that a lot of people out there nowadays are trying to make a living on YouTube. They are getting tons of followers. They are getting ads onto their own personal content that they're putting up on YouTube, and they are making money, along with Google, on these videos. And they range from all kinds of content. And we covered a story about a particular content creator. I'm forgetting the name of that show that we both
I don't recall.
Better Every Day?
No, Smarter Every Day. Sure.
Yeah. And he was making noise about how he has seen his content that he made being edited and being repurposed and put up on Facebook without any credit to himself
right. By
others. And this isn't a case where somebody on Facebook can put up video and make money on it, but they certainly can get a lot of recognition and a lot of followers from having great content up. And if they're stealing it so blatantly where they don't even give the creator credit, then potentially the creator's just missing out on a lot of views on his own site where he does make money.
Mm-hmm.
So what was interesting about that story is that videos on Facebook are relatively new. Videos on Facebook, I'm talking about the native video player in Facebook.
So, not when you link to a YouTube channel on Facebook, which does normally have a player in there, but when you actually upload the video to Facebook.
Right. The player, the Chrome around the player, the play button and the little progress bar at the bottom, they actually look different because if it's embedded from YouTube, it's got YouTube's branding to it. Uh-huh. If it's from Facebook, it's actually a little plainer. But Facebook has had an initiative to use more video. And so they actually are, it looks like, pushing native videos that mm-hmm. are hosted on YouTube, on Facebook, over other embedded videos from YouTube and others. And the remarkable thing about this is the numbers of views that these videos were getting on Facebook were just dramatic. The really popular videos from Smarter Every Day, which took months and months and months to get these numbers, were getting the exact same numbers and more in just a day or so.
Interesting.
And of course, the pattern on Facebook is that something comes into your news newsfeed and you see it, but after it falls off the bottom of your newsfeed, many people don't go looking for it, and so the viewership really happens up front. Mm-hmm. And these numbers were showing that. Well, the follow-up here is that there's an article that goes into detail about what those numbers really mean. It's a great little article on YouTube, and the author talks about how Facebook actually produces those numbers, where they come from. And I don't use the Facebook app or the website.
So one of the things the Facebook app does is, as you're scanning through your feed, if there's a video in it, it'll auto-play the feed, but not necessarily turn the audio on.
Exactly.
So are they counting that auto-play?
They are not only counting that auto-play, but they are counting it after 3 seconds.
So 3 seconds says, I've watched the video.
3 seconds without the audio, and they're going to count that as a play. So those incredible numbers that they're reporting for the video views are entirely inflated and not trustworthy.
Yeah.
It's still, though, a problem that this is going on.
Do they have embedded advertising capabilities in those videos? Because that's one thing I don't see is ads normally. Normally it's a video link and then links to somewhere else.
Right, they're not monetizing it directly. Mm-hmm. Of course, Facebook monetizes the entire site.
Right.
They're making money off of the fact that people are using the service and those ads are in the sidebar.
And the copyrighted material that's being republished by other people, clearly Facebook is benefiting from.
Right, right. Yeah. So the argument is Facebook is making money off of something that is stolen material.
All right.
And they know about this problem. They're talking about it. But the stat that is worth bringing up here is, out of the 1,000 most popular Facebook videos, there are people that believe, this study from Tubular Labs, that 725, that's 72% of those videos may be freebooted videos, may be taken from other sources and repurposed without the creator's consent.
That's a lot of copyright infringement.
Yeah.
Interesting. I it's one of those things where it feels like we're going to see at a later date some kind of mass lawsuit.
Well, yeah, and Google, YouTube itself went through this in the early days because they had to create their content ID system to avoid copyrighted material being put up, which, of course, we talk about it going...
Still happens all the time.
It still happens, and then the overreaction, the taking things down too easily that are actually legally up there happens as well.
Right.
It's not a perfect system at all.
All right. Speaking of not perfect systems, printers for the years have been the bane of everyone's existence. There's a wonderful clip from Office Space, 1999 film, about three workers getting so fed up with the printer's horrible error messages, they just take it to a field and beat it up like gangster style, like, you know, like a old... gangster movie, you know.
Yeah, my wife and I are so ready to throw out our printer we have right now. It's brand new.
I don't know anyone that likes their printer. You know, it's one of those things that the printers are easy to hate. These cheap inkjet printers, right? They cost under $100, but the cartridges cost $30, right? And you have to seem to buy the cartridges a lot. In fact, when you get the printer, the cartridge you get with the printer is a low ink level cartridge. It's the free one. It's definitely a... let's make money on the cartridges. And we've seen that because the copyright enforcement, I mean, they're using the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to have the cartridges, which actually the print heads as well, have encrypted protection on it. And therefore, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act comes into play if you try to circumvent their security model. But basically, it's all about making you pay for higher-end printers, cartridges. And you can go to almost a lot of places and get these cartridges refilled, but there's always a battle of resetting the DRM built into the cartridge.
And there's also the scare tactics of if you use the wrong ink, it's not going to look nearly as good.
And you'll lose your warranty on your printer.
Yeah.
Warranty on a $30 printer doesn't really seem to matter. But.
I got to fess up. I really feel like we're responsible for this. We don't want to pay good money for good technology. Sometimes
printers, it becomes so frustrating for me is that when I want to print things, I send it to a print shop, right?
Right.
We got Bay Photo in town, and if you're a Costco member, you can get Costco prints as well. Bay Photo has excellent photos. We've actually had Larry on the show a couple times over the years to talk about his local business, which is now kind of an international business, even though they're run from Santa Cruz, right, in Scotts Valley, actually. In any case, so going to a print shop for photo print makes a lot of sense. But when you want to print something to hand to your kid has a paper assignment and stuff, you all of a sudden have to deal with this printer, and it's constantly a battle. Well, Epson's kind of listening to us, and they've released this new printer called the EcoTank. Horrible name. But the EcoTank, theoretically, has a 2-year printing capability. It's a printer that runs a lot more expensive, right? It's more like the $400 printer rather than the $70 printer. It's probably the same technology in general, but instead of having ink cartridges that you plug in, there's a pool, the reservoir pools that you fill up with a like a squeegee, and it has a year supply or 2 year supply of ink. Now, we haven't seen review models of these yet. So everything I'm talking about right now is what Epson's saying, and therefore it's not reliable in a lot of ways, because of course Epson's one of these people that's trying to make money. But if you look at the numbers, it equates to about the same price over the period of time, but you don't have to deal with these little cartridges.
Well, here's the thing. If they're asking people to spend $400 on a printer, I hope that they're spending that little extra at the factory to get just a little bit more reliable pieces in there, because people are going to really complain when their $400 printer breaks.
Well,
I'm hoping that's the case.
My hope is that as well. And when we see review of this, we'll know. But exactly, we want higher quality printers. Like, I don't want the cheap thing. I want something that's actually robust and can function. You know, the enterprise market or the business market has had these for a long time, right? The large, but they're the size of a dishwasher. They're huge machines.
Yeah, but the calculation that a business will make is that they know that if they're going to use this over the course of 5 or 10 years, then they're going to get more value out of spending a little bit of money up front.
Yeah. When I lived in a tighter community in Felton, there was a lot of house in the area, and I thought, well, I should take I should get one of these big printers and just have everyone add to the printer pool. And then I realized, wait, I'm just going to do printer tech support for all my neighbors. I'm not doing that. Call me on Saturdays if you want to do that. In any case, so I'm hoping that as reviews come forward, it would emerge, because I'm definitely done with these cheap printers and the ink markup. It just is not a fun experience for any consumer. So, Brian, let's talk about some coding and education, shall we?
Oh, yeah. So there's all sorts of education models out there, because there's all sorts of business models out there. But we're in a talent crunch for technology in Silicon Valley and across the country. There's been all sorts of news over the years about different H-1B visa stories about getting people from out of the country to come. There's been lots of stories about how do we get more diversity in tech to get more people involved. This school called Coding House has come up with a business model that's brand new to them, which I'm interested in to see how it works out, because it's so curious. They've decided that they're going to waive tuition. They're going to have free tuition. Their business model now will be to take a percentage of the first 6 months of your income after you have gone through their program. So in one sense, I applaud this. They obviously have the confidence that their students will be able to go out and get a worthy job, and it may be good for everybody. But I don't know much about the school at all. However, I am going to be watching them. There is one little caveat. You do have to put $6,000 up front as sort of a deposit, which will come off of that percentage that they will take in the first 6 months.
So free tuition except for not?
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's pretty low.
It's a marketing ploy there, but
it's kind of like a buy-in, though, in the sense that, yeah.
Yeah, so still, this is an interesting model, and for some people, it will give them a chance to get in education in tech and into these fundamental web technologies that are so useful these days that wouldn't have that chance otherwise.
Yeah. So a little bit of a throwback. We talked about internet cable here on GeekSpeak in 2004, August 6th, 2004 episode. We called it just internet cable.
And internet you can go, cable.
And because of the work I did this last week, you're welcome to go listen to that old show. But we talked about how, wow, maybe cable companies could provide internet.
How do you send that over that wire?
It's exactly.
Just TV signals.
All that stuff we talked about is really fun on that old episode. Stick with us. We'll talk about newer information about Comcast and cable in just a minute. You're listening to GeekSpeak here on KOSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak here on KOSP. If you'd like to listen to, see more of what we talk about, 15 years, yeah, right. what we talk about is up at geekspeak.org. You can look at the old shows. You can look at notes of the more current shows. We take links and notes about everything we talk about, so you can do more research if you'd like. I'm with Brian Young. He's a developer and a hacker and geek. And I, of course, am Lyle Troxell. I'm also a geek programmer, photographer, and radio host for over 15 years now today of my anniversary show, which is kind of fun. During that time, and we will get to a Comcast story in a second, during that time, we had Al Luckow, who was on for a couple years doing these wonderful USB of the week bits. I thought I'd play one for one of our anniversary episodes.
Now, I've brought up some pretty ridiculous USB devices over the past year here on GeekSpeak, but I have to tell you, this one takes the cake. The world has absolutely no need for this thing. Ready? It's a USB blender alarm clock. You heard me right. It's an alarm clock in the shape of a blender. It has little styrofoam beads inside that kind of churn when the alarm goes off, and of course plays funny music. What's the music, you say? Well, here it is. It's one of those tunes that isn't really enjoyable in any way, but it has some sort of audio narcotic in it that makes you keep humming it all day until you go insane. Now here are the features of this device. Time, date, an alarm clock, AM and PM, and it weighs 230 grams. So there you have it. Another useless USB device. Man, listen to that music. I think there's even a whistle in there.
Well, thanks, Al. And of course, you can listen to old episodes of Geek Speak where we have a lot of USB, crazy USBs of the week up at geekspeak.org. Hey, if you're interested in this show, you'll probably be interested in other programs here on KOSP, like the Seventh Avenue Project. People suffering from Cotar's syndrome think they're dead. Yes, victims of body integrity identity disorder believe their own limbs belong to someone else. Schizophrenics feel their thoughts aren't their own. These and other mental afflictions offer clues as to how the brain constructs our sense of self and what happens when things go wrong. KOSP's Robert Pauly talks to science writer Anil Ananthaswamy about his new book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. That's on the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow, Sunday at 1 here on KOSP. And of course, every day, all the time, at 7thAvenueProject.com. And that domain starts with a 7, which, by the way, when domain names were first released, you were not allowed to start them with a digit. You had to
just like function names?
Well, yeah, I guess in some languages, yeah, most languages. and still to this day, when I see a domain name with a number in the front, I'm like, hey, they broke their rules. Of course, domain name rules have changed over the years. Over the 15 years I've been doing this program, at least.
Yeah, what are we up to? We started with three that we could easily get back then.
Yeah, com, org, and net. Yeah. Those are all the root domain names, and now they're as many as you possibly could think of. In fact, Google just registered a new one for their parent company. You might have heard Alphabet is the new parent company of Google.
Okay, this gets a little confusing.
Yeah, I know.
What do you mean?
Well, just Google it. No, so Larry Page, the CEO of Google, made a blog post this week talking about how Google will actually be a subsidiary of a new company called Alphabet, though it's really kind of a name change and a swip around because all your stock that's Google and the trade GOOG and GOOGL, those two ticker symbols for the NASDAQ, are still going to represent the parent company, Alphabet. So they really just kind of said the company that owns everything that Google is now called Alphabet. One of its largest companies, the one that makes all the money, is called Google.
And has a new CEO.
Yeah, the CEO of Google is will be. I had this down.
Sundar Pichai.
Yes, thank you. So, Sundar Pichai, and he'll be the CEO of Google, which is basically all the internet arms. So the search, the apps, Google Plus, Google Photos, all of those. There are some other companies that already exist as subsidiaries, like YouTube, still run by a different CEO and such. And Larry Page will be the CEO of the new company, Alphabet, and the president will be Sergey Brin. Both of those are founders, of course. And it will basically completely replace the name. The domain name they use for Alphabet is abc.xyz.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. Kind of a cool domain name. But it really doesn't change much, except that the company basically will be able to show profits in the internet space and all the losses in the medical and car and all the stuff they do.
I was kind of surprised that they wanted to do this because hiding all those losses is a great way for them to do all of these really crazy out there things, putting internet up on balloons around the world or self-driving cars, these moonshot ideas.
Or contact lenses that read your blood glucose.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some amazing things.
Yeah, which the where it really makes sense to me, though, is you know, they put forth this idea that Google is to organize the world's information. And and really, when it comes to blood glucose levels, is that organizing the world's information? Is I don't know.
Well, the other aspect of that is that if one of these other company business plans is not to collect personal data, but to do something else like medical information that should be more private, it might not be that the Google Internet company, which is still probably the one that will collect all data. We'll have maybe not have that direct access to it. So it has also some barriers in that regard.
Does it really? I mean, conceptually, I love that idea. We've talked a lot about privacy and concern, but I haven't seen any indication that they're actually divorcing the divisions that much.
No, I wouldn't say that they necessarily are. I'm just saying that from a separation perspective, from an ownership perspective, you'll have a CEO running the medical space. You'll have a CEO running the internet search engine giant thing, and they will have debate about ownership and what's right for the product they're making. But with regards to have the bottom line and not hiding the giant investment in robotics, whatever, the parent company is still the one that's reporting, right? It's still doing the taxes, still doing the board of directors, still doing, you know, the...
You can't invest directly in Google Fiber
or
the new Google, which is most of what you know.
Yeah, I wonder what Fiber will call it. Let's call it Fiber. Anyway, kind of cool little story. Okay, so I teased you about some broadband stories, and just in general, Comcast has been kind of accidentally public about some information regarding their caps. A data cap. So you buy internet service, you get a certain amount of broadband, and you'll hear that like 100 megabits per second or 10 megabits per second or 6 megabits per second. This is how fast your internet connection is. You need a certain threshold to do streaming video. In any case, there's also caps, the amount of usage you use over a period of time.
So there's speed and then there's volume.
Yeah. You know,
the amount that goes through the wire.
And Comcast actually has rolled out a 300 gigabyte cap.
Well, they've stated
in some places. Yeah,
they've stated it for years that it's there. Though usually it's a we have this cap, but we're not enforcing it right now.
And the reason why it'd be kind of silly to enforce it in some ways is, for example, if you have a 100 megabit connection, you can use 300 gigabytes in 6 hours, right? So it's like, and this cap is for a month. So it seems to be kind of ridiculous. Also, what's the business reason to do this? Now, of course, there's conceptually, if everyone uses too much network on their system, you'll have a failure at some point where there just won't be enough throughput.
Yeah, but in the geek circles, what we talk about is what is the actual cost of them providing that data to you? They've laid the wires. They've got their connection to the backbone of the internet, and they've made their deals to connect to those.
And a lot of this stuff is public.
Yeah, a lot of it is. And they have peering agreements. But what is the actual cost that they have to transfer those bits that they're charging you extra for now that you've gone over your cap? And from a geek number point of view, it's never added up. It seems much closer to free than to the extra money that they charge for going over the limit. So maybe there's another way that would make more sense to charge us that would be more in line with their actual costs.
Additionally, in some places where they've rolled this out, when people reach this cap, they actually then get charged per amount of usage. So it's really dangerous. It's just like your phone company, right? Your cell phone service. When you don't have an unlimited plan, it becomes stressful. Right, you potentially could get charged more. And you've heard of crazy stories where people are charged thousands of dollars because they did something wrong using their phone. In any case, the Comcast Vice President of Internet Services, Jason Livingood, tweeted a response. The question was, serious question, why are Comcast caps so low compared to the speeds they're being sold at? 100 megabits can hit 300 gigabytes in 6 hours. And Jason Livingood, the Vice President of Internet Services, actually responded publicly, of course, because that's how Twitter is. No idea. I'm involved in the engineering side to manage the measurement system, but don't weigh in on the business policies. So basically saying it's a business policy, right? It's not a technical policy, which just makes you want to hate Comcast a little bit more. So the next question you've got is, could Comcast do a better job of providing internet service, right? And where there's this wonderful ISP called SandyNet, and they're in Oregon, and they launched nearly 15 years ago with DSL and wireless service. And this summer, they're putting a final touch on a citywide upgrade to fiber. So everyone gets fiber. We covered a show recently about Santa Cruz is going to get fiber in the same kind of way. Small ISP comes together with the city. They merge forces. They put a whole bunch of stuff underground. And after a while, people have fiber.
And the financing can be either somewhat public, somewhat all private. There's different models to do it, right?
That's right, yeah. And so in this city, the upgrade was paid for with a $7.5 million revenue bond, same type of thing, right? So then after a period of time, we'll get paid back. And despite being subsidized by taxpayer dollars, prices are still $40 a month for 100 megabits per second. So that's the price point they now got, which is
$40 a month for
100 megabits. 100 megabits fast. You and I don't have that at home with our current Comcast.
No, I have that in my internal network.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's an internal network that's running pretty well. It's 100 megabits, sometimes gigabit, but... Yeah. And at the price point of $40, obviously, if they're doing that, they're doing it without a lot of, you know, they had to build infrastructure.
And did they say how long it'll take them to pay that infrastructure back? Is it 15 years?
15 years, yeah. Well, no, they've been around for 15 years. I'm not sure the timeline for that one. I think the Cruise Isle one in Santa Cruz is going to be 20 years paying back. But pretty cool. The town is 30 miles from Portland. And of course, they couldn't get DSL everywhere because the phone service that was doing this is more of a rural kind of town.
And of course,
it wasn't close enough.
Those rural towns, it's also harder to make the business case for one of the bigger companies to come in and provide service as well. I got to say, 13 years ago when, oh no, I'm sorry, 11 years ago when Comcast came to my house, I was so thankful. It was the only internet option I had other than dial up at the time. And I really credit it to almost saving my marriage, because the frustration I had to come home from work where we had this incredibly fast connection, and I just wanted to download my Audible books to go listen to the show the next drive, and it would just stall out so much. I had to use all this voodoo just to get it to download.
Yeah. We did talk about the cable company being the ISP. And we did that in 2004.
You talk about cable companies have never had a good reputation? Did you talk about customer
service? We talked
service
about
what you could expect
right off the line. I'll read you the little write up that we put. Good rural internet access is hard to find. Most people in outlying areas are too far from their telephone company's central office to get DSL, and satellite internet access is expensive and problematic. The problematic is actually the ping time. Your local cable company might be your internet provider savior, but it might not be that simple. The Geeks Talk internet cable and being firm with the customer helpline, because as it came into the area, just like you, the geeks that were involved in the program at the time, all of us tried to get it. And the tech support people didn't know what we were talking about. They thought they were looking for a channel called internet. You know, like they didn't understand, like the tech support people that you'd call in, just the helpline did not know what the heck was going on for the early adopters. You know?
Yeah, well, if we could switch over to internet being thought of as a utility, I mean, I'm all for the private market. I'm all for private enterprise, but this has become such a important part of our country's infrastructure on how we build our businesses, how low-income people get access to information, how we run our libraries nowadays. All of this is based on how the internet's working. And if we could switch over to a utility mindset, and it may be publicly funded, maybe not, whatever works for the region, but just think of this as something, as a dumb pipe that the private enterprise companies do not want to think of it that way. They can't make a good profit thinking of it as a dumb pipe. They have to have these value-added services. But if we can just make sure everybody has a decent, fast internet connection, it'll help our communities, our country.
And I got to say, the SandyNet company, which is the ISP in Sandy, Oregon, they were up against Wave, a cable company, and Frontier, a DSL provider. And before the upgrade, the fiber upgrade, before this started happening, SandyNet's market share was about 30% of homes in the city, and it's 3,700 homes in the city. And they expect it to be 50% within, more than half the city, 50% of the city, once the project is actually hooked up to everyone on the waiting list. So it looks like they're going to pretty quickly become the dominant player in that area, of course. And the whole point is that it's the community itself is kind of doing it, right? And at the end of the period, the community owns the network, which is the way it should be, or the way a utility should be, in my mind.
And it's
something
like
again, I was raised here in Santa
Cruz.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so we've done a few of my stories. We've got to get back to you, sir. But first, let's do a little break. So we're talking with Brian Young, and I'm Lyle Troxell on this 15th anniversary episode of Geek Speak. Stick with us, won't you? And you're listening to KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, hosting Geek Speak with Brian Young. Brian, let's talk about universal messaging, shall we?
That being a sort of a retrospective show, well, not really, but talking about the past, do you remember back when the war was between instant messaging between AIM and Yahoo Messenger?
Oh, absolutely.
And MSN Messenger?
I never used MSN, I don't think. Well, I probably did a little bit, but yeah, AIM and Yahoo Messenger were kind of the de facto primaries. And of course, there was also text messaging if you had a cell phone, and that always cost a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, but that was later. I mean, AIM Wars was right around 2000.
Yeah.
So I was back then definitely in the camp of, I just want to use one tool that I know I can get all of my friends to reach them on. And so I would go out and try to find Trillium or Aidium or all these other tools that...
I thought it was Aidium. Is it Aidium?
I called it Aidium.
All right.
You know, that's the problem with all this stuff. You read it on the internet. You don't know what you're supposed to pronounce.
Yeah.
So I was very much trying to cobble these systems together so that I could have a unified system. It never really worked. And we always thought that it would unify. And there were some attempts to that. But no sooner than those attempts start taking hold that we have some new technology comes along, as it always does.
Mm-hmm.
First, SMS became much more popular. And then we had smartphones come around, where all of a sudden we had an explosion of apps and services. So there's a write-up in Wired Online that I thought was pretty funny. I don't fully agree with it, but he goes into all the different services that are out there and all the different ways that you can get a hold of
a person.
Yeah. everything from the ones you know, like Facebook Messenger, or if you're a Apple user, iMessage, or of course SMS. There's other tools that kind of get on the edge of this, like Slack. We've been using Slack lately for organizing our shows. It's more for...
it's like community messaging.
Right? Yeah,
so we've made a community called GeekSpeak, and then all the geeks involved in that are associated. So when we send a text, we send to the entire group.
It's not intended to look somebody up. You're
right.
making a team.
Right, because you're on one project. WeChat is, of course, really popular overseas.
Yeah.
Major in China.
And on that service, you can do all sorts of things. You can book train tickets. You can control your smart home devices, because they've built that all into the service. Well, this article goes on about this, and his main thrust is that he wants one universal system. He's tired of this. There's too many different ways to get a hold of people, and he just wants to be able to tell somebody, talk to me on this channel, talk to me this service.
Yeah, but that, I mean, what, email?
Well, here's the thing. I sympathized with them 15 years ago, but at this point now, a smartphone has superseded all of my need for this, because all of a sudden, instead of relying on some one unified system that imposes the lowest common denominator of the different services, we now have this explosion of just a simple icon on your phone, which has a way to innovate about how to do this. I mean,
right.
if you tried to shoehorn Slack into instant messaging, you'd never get the group features.
Absolutely.
If you tried to do the same thing with WeChat, you'd never get all of the smart...
Pay and instance. Yeah, I get that. And additionally, since it's on your device and you're getting the same kind of interaction, the operating system's telling you, hey, you got a WeChat, or you got a Facebook post, or you got a Twitter update. All those kind of alerts are the same type of tag to you saying, launch the app,
right.
Launch the app.
Yeah. And I think the real key is the fact that we get notified, these push notifications that can come to us. All of a sudden, you don't need that unified interface. You have a folder, or what do they use on Android? Do they call them folders on your home screen?
Yeah, I don't know.
A home screen widget.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you can pull up your six different services you use. And yeah, it kind of mirrors how my friendships are, because I have friends from high school. I have friends from college. I have friends from traveling to New Zealand. I have friends...
And are they all on different services?
They tend to be on different services. And
because the time when you connected with them.
The time when I connected with them, the social circles that they tended to gravitate into.
Did you finally install Facebook Messenger? I just did this week. I finally installed it because I needed to do something, and it was too hard to switch away. I've been resisting the Facebook Messenger one because it was annoying.
I've been having a hard time talking about all the Facebook technologies, because I have not used the website or the Facebook app or the Facebook Messenger app at all. But I still use Facebook a lot.
Through the website?
No, I haven't used the website. I have to go on.
How do you use
it,
then?
So they bought this little company, Pushpop Press, and uh-huh, they released an app based on their technology and their the developers. And they're really fascinating developers. I really like their work. And that app was called Paper.
Yeah, sure. I know Paper.
And
I was using Paper for a long time before messaging in Facebook, because the Facebook app turned off messaging, but
right,
Paper still had it.
Yeah, so that's how I do it. So I haven't
Paper's
been pushed.
A cool app.
Yeah. It's cool. It's a different way to use your Facebook feed. It's also pretty. I like pretty things.
Yeah, it's a good app. And from the iOS development perspective, I think it's only iOS.
It is only iOS, because the technology was specific to it.
Paper is a Facebook client, basically, that operates differently than when you used to. And because of that, they don't have things like video feed autoplay in them.
And they haven't been pushed to take messaging out of the app.
Right. So it's a less featured, cleaner way of dealing with Facebook, I guess, is one way to think about it. Hey, how big's the hard drive on your computer? Because I noticed that your laptop in front of you have an external hard drive.
Yeah, yeah. You like how that's velcroed onto the back of the screen?
It's very geeky. In fact, the first time I ever saw that was Ben. Ben Jaffe, who's on the show, of course, regularly.
He beat me to it?
He did this years ago when he was in college, and because of that, he had two hard drives associated with his Kinect machine, and he'd pulled out an optical drive and put in a hard drive in that slot too, because he was doing a lot of video editing in college.
I've done that before.
And because of that, and after talking with him about 10 minutes, I was like, you should be on the radio program with me. Anyway, yeah, so you have this external Thunderbolt hard drive attached to your laptop, I'm assuming because you've got more storage on it.
Yeah, I do video, I do graphics, I do a lot of things that require a lot of data, and I want to be able to have my photographs with me.
So this month, the Flash Memory Summit happened here in California, and Samsung, one of the big players in storage, released the newest largest hard drive. And when I say largest capacity hard drive, fits in a laptop.
So I am waiting to get my first terabyte SSD.
You haven't gotten one?
I haven't gotten a terabyte.
No, I haven't.
They're too expensive. But yeah. And you know, if I had a terabyte in this machine, I wouldn't need that
extra hard drive.
Yeah,
and that wouldn't tease you as much. So they have released an SSD drive that is the largest drive. This is the first because normally the larger drives are spinning platters. In fact, Seagate, started in Santa Cruz, by the way, has is the current largest hard drive, a 10 terabyte hard drive. I think that's a large, I don't think that's a 2.5 inch drive.
I think it's a desktop.
Desktop.
Size drive.
So there's two types of hard drive sizes, basically. Ones that fit in laptops, which are called 2.5 inch, and ones that fit in other machines, which is called 3.5 inch, I think. But they're not really metric. They're actually metric in size, not really English, but anyway.
But the important part is the technology to make a spinning platter hard drive, a traditional hard drive, has always been so much cheaper that if you're going to get a high capacity, you're going to do it that way.
That's right. They're slower, but cheaper. They also fail in more catastrophic ways, or can fail. They both can fail.
I could argue that.
Samsung has built a new hard drive that's 16 terabytes and fits in a laptop. 16 terabytes. Now, this is just a proof of concept, and the way they are doing this is with their 3D lithography mechanism. It's a NAND device. I guess I could get into a little bit of what NAND. No, we won't get into NAND. We've talked about this kind of stuff in the past. NAND is just a certain type of cell technology. But this thing has 48 layers of 3 bits per cell TLC, 3D VNAND. Okay, so this is one platter having multiple 48 layers of cells, NAND cells.
You call it a platter. You mean it's more like integrated circuit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I call it a platter because when you're talking about making a chip, you actually do lithography, light transmitted separation, like silk screening, onto these things called platters, which are sort of a slice of the silicate substrate. And then you build up layers of transistors and other stuff silk screening, basically. But lithography.
So they're not creating a platter and then like gluing the 48 of them together. They're doing this in layers
etching
surface.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I don't even know how they do it. It's neat. They do it in 3D. That's why it's called 3D, vertical 3D. They're basically burning these things lower levels. I don't know how they do it. It's fascinating to me. But they're doing 48 chips, 48 layers. That's how they're able to get such amazing density of 16 terabytes. And of course, for their example system, they provided a server that, God, it was something like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
It was terabytes and terabytes of storage.
It added up to 3/4 of a petabyte.
Yeah.
Start getting that into your vocabulary now.
Yeah, it's coming
our way.
Now, Samsung it's a proof of concept drive. It's the fastest one. They don't have a price on the 16 terabyte. But just to put it in perspective, currently the enterprise grade, these are important enterprise grade because they're a little more reliable. The 1 terabyte SSD enterprise level will cost about $1,000 US. And a 8 terabyte, which would be a spinning platter, is going to cost like $700. So we're talking like it's still a lot cheaper to get a lot more storage on spinning platters.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
SSDs are still expensive, but they're a lot faster, as we talked about. They're the best way to improve your machine. And we're not sure when they'll come out, hopefully this later next year. And the estimates, our complete estimates, is like 7,000 US to get one of these 16 terabyte drives.
Oh my God.
So you won't be replacing it soon on your machine.
But yeah. I will say the thing that does slow down SSDs is when they fill up and they don't have enough places to move the bits around because of the way they write. So that sounds like the answer there.
Yeah, just don't even worry about it. You'll never fill it up. I think...
Where's the quote that Bill Gates
made? 64 kilobytes. You never need more than that.
Yeah, that should be enough.
Yeah, exactly. You know, speaking of hard drive storage and stuff, with talking about the throwback of the 15 years of the program, I have WAV files of all the episodes of Geek Speak, right? And it used to be burned on disks, and that's an hour-long WAV file is one CD. So for years, I had this giant book for the first few years, and then I got a NAS storage device with, I think I've got 6 terabytes in it or something, and all the shows fit in there, no problem.
So have you read that data off of the disks? Because yeah. they do go bad eventually.
Yeah, well, it's a duplicate RAID 10, and yeah, I have read it off and looked at it once in a while, but I haven't recently backed that one up again. So it's possible to lose all the core audio files. All the MP3s I've got multiple copies of, so it's not a big deal from that perspective. But in any case, it's a lot of storage to deal with. You know, it's a lot of data to deal with. And this is not even video. This is just audio. Yeah. All right, where were we, sir? Let's do a couple quickies. Well, shall we?
I thought this was interesting. So, you know, Apple is known for not giving you all the features that you might want as a geek. And they try to make it brain dead simple, or at least that was the idea, is to make it simple. I would argue they've gotten much more complex in the years, but they have quietly allowed something that I think is really helpful to a lot of people out there that are starting to rely on the iCloud service. One of the big failings of the service was if something went wrong, like all your contacts from your phone started to disappear and they were synced to the iCloud and they were synced to your Mac, all of a sudden those contacts could be gone forever unless on your Mac, maybe you back them up. Well, they are now allowing an option to restore previous files, previous states of your iCloud, whether that be the files that are shared, like contacts, or the actual files that apps create.
They're kind of doing a time machine kind of concept in iCloud?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
It's not going to go back forever, but they will give you at least some recourse if things go terribly wrong.
Which they do sometimes.
And this is important for all cloud storage, whether it's Google or Apple or any of the other ones.
Or Dropbox,
You know, technology normally, is not perfect. There are bugs.
And normally there is history in these things. Dropbox has it. Google has histories. So it's nice to see Apple kind of
joining the crowd.
I'm assuming Apple's responded to that because they've had problems.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of problems, Miles chimes in to say, wafer, not platter.
Ah, that's why I didn't understand.
That's why you didn't understand what I was talking about, because I didn't know what I was talking about. All right, so another quickie.
Here's a fun story about, I think we all know this is coming, but it's nice to see some data on it. Over the course of the last 2 years, the percentage of people reaching the internet, looking at web pages via their devices has really shifted. So in 2013, two-thirds of all internet traffic... I'm trying to get the exact number. No, it's actually three-quarters of all internet traffic that is looking at a website is coming from a desktop computer. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to play a little fast and loose with the categories here, or a tablet. So you can argue whether tablets are their own category or whether they belong more with desktops or more with mobile.
When you say desktops, though, you also mean laptops.
Desktops, laptops.
Okay. So like a computer, traditional computer with a keyboard versus a phone versus a tablet.
Tablet. So if you lump tablets in with those other computers, you're looking at a real shift, because now we are at the point where 50% of the traffic, a little bit more than 50% of the traffic, is clearly coming from smartphone usage. Mm-hmm. and mobile usage like that.
Sure.
Whereas laptop and desktop usage is going way down and is now less than that. I've got some charts that we will link to on GeekSpeak to show you the trends, and it's coming. We are definitely in the sort of post PC world.
Yeah, yeah, we're in the mobile world now. Very cool. So let's talk a quick about a car hacking thing that happened recently. In fact, in 2012, which is quite a while ago, researchers from Redmond University in the Netherlands discovered a security flaw in the chips used in what's called the immobilizer, the RFID immobilizer. This is the fob you've got in your car that you either have a key, you turn a key ignition, or you just have a fob. Like in my car, I don't actually have an ignition. Inside there's an RFID chip and some security protocol to wirelessly communicate to the car to say, I do exist in your vehicle. And the reason this exists in high-end vehicles in 2012 had this, and most all vehicles have it now, but the theft prevention system basically says even if a key is in the ignition and you turn it, you can't drive that far unless that RFID chip is in the car. And that allows you to say the car can't be stolen just by copying a key, because copying a key is actually relatively easy to do. The physical key.
The physical key.
So these are these chipped keys that cost so much money, right?
Oh,
when you lose
okay.
one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So
that's what they are.
It's not necessarily just the fob that opens the door that
it's
has
the chipped
chip
key.
In it.
Yeah, yeah. So and then what's happened is because we've relied more on that, we've let go of the key, and now some vehicles don't even need a key. They just the chip fob. But there's a little more tech in some of these. But the ones I'm talking about is the Volkswagen, Audi, Fiat, Honda, and Volvo vehicles. All had used this technology in 2012, and some security researchers found that it's actually relatively to crack the encryption they're using on the communication protocol.
Relatively easy to do that?
Yes, and I'll talk about relatively easy in just a second. For a human being, it would be very, very hard. For a computer, it's not though bad. They use a 64-bit secret key, but when they communicate with the car, when the fob communicates with the car and vice versa, the communication leaks some data. And because of that leaking, they get down to having, they can do tests on it. With 196,000 tests, they can find the number, okay? They can find the encryption key.
That's always the key with encryption is how many times you can iterate over a test.
That's right. So they have to do 196,000 times to do this. Now, in most services, that would fail because you have to physically maybe type in your key in your phone or on your computer. But mostly the services that actually provide like internet service, when you attempt too many times, you get locked out for a period of time. So 196,000 times would just be not accessible because you'd get locked out. You have to do it over a period of time. It might take weeks to do it. But when you're dealing with a system that allows you to try indefinitely and it's very quick to try, you can do that in 30 minutes.
So it takes them 30 minutes to get those iterations?
Right. They have to get the key and the handshake protocol. They have to listen to it with a radio, and then they can crack it in 30 minutes. They announced this to the company in 2012. Volkswagen sued them with a cease and desist, so they couldn't publish the article, even though they gave them a 9-month window to fix the problem. They said, look, in 9 months, we're going to go talk about this at some hacking convention thing, so deal with it. They did an embargo, basically, on a forced legal suit to hide this data since 2012.
This is the basic problem when an old industry gets brought into the computer age and gets virtualized in all these different ways. They just don't understand that if some white hat or gray hat hacker, these are our terms to talk about the good researchers out there.
Is
the best of car talk. KUSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet's gigabit fiber broadband network, built and maintained in Santa Cruz County for home and business. More information at cruise.io.com or 459-6301.
And there's a really great example of 15 years experience. I was running the board, and I totally didn't watch the clock effectively. And so when NPR started, I wasn't ready, and it played, and I had to cut off Brian. I'm not going to go into more details about what we were going to talk about, but we were just going to probably close up that story relatively well. I'm assuming that Brian would have been extremely eloquent in his descriptions of closing that story. We'll have another one next week. Hope you're enjoying GeekSpeak. Hey, you know, love to hear your feedback. I, over the years, have taken a lot of critique on things I do well and things I don't do well, how the show could be improved, and I would love your feedback on what you think could be better about GeekSpeak. In looking at the past years of the program, especially the beginning of the program in 2000 and so, while I was working on this, I realized that we used to have a lot of special guests on. We used to book special guests probably once or twice a month. And that means some expert in the field. But if there's topics you want us to cover, love to hear about them. And do you want special guests? What kind of stuff would you like to hear on the program? Love to hear it. Hey, thanks for listening to GeekSpeak so much. And, you know, giving us a review on iTunes and such, you've probably heard on other podcasts. It does help out a lot. Spread the word. I'd love to get more people involved in the show and interested in the show. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.